Since 2005, Blue Hat has been where the security research community and Microsoft come together as peers.
To debate and discuss, share and challenge, celebrate and learn.
On the Blue Hat podcast, join me, Nick Fillingham.
And me, Wendy Zanoni, for conversations with researchers, responders and industry leaders, both inside and outside of Microsoft.
Working to secure the planet's technology and create a safer world for all.
And now, on with the Blue Hat podcast.
Welcome to the Blue Hat podcast, Dustin Haywood, aka Evil Mog. Dustin, thanks for joining us. Or do I call you Evil?
You can call me Evil, you can call me Mog, you can call me Dustin. I'm open for all of the above.
Is it Mog, M-O-G, as in like a Moggy, like a cat?
Like the Final Fantasy character, Mog the Moogle from Final Fantasy VI, little fluffy thing with wings and a little red pom-pom on its head.
I've never played it. I'm sorry. I just lost nerd points, I know, but never played it. Is that a cat character, though?
It's a cat-like character, yes. I mean, where it actually originally came from, the first aircraft I ever soloed in was a glider with the call sign Charlie Golf Mike Oscar Golf, so CG Mog. And then I used to play a lot of Tetris. And so rather than using my initials in there, I used to put Mog because it just happened to fit and be rapid to type. I used to have a really bad Tetris addiction back when you could smoke in bowling alleys. I'd go with a roll of quarters and a pack of cigarettes. Whichever ran out first, I'd stop.
Wow. I'm like, there's so much to unpack in that question there. Let's back up a little bit. So you're joining us on the Blue Hat podcast because you were a presenter on day two of Blue Hat October 23, you presented on NTLM, and we'll get into that in just a minute. But yeah, let's do an introduction. Dustin Haywood, aka Evil Mog, who are you and what do you do here?
All right, so I'm Evil Mog. I'm a member of Team Hashcat. I specialize in password cracking. I'm also the chief architect of IBM's X-Force, so I handle global technology for hackers, incident responders, threat intelligence analysts globally for IBM.
Awesome. And you are, I want to say you're an expert in NTLM and sort of the surrounding technologies, and you absolutely are, but you're also... You're almost like a cheerleader, though, for the, you know, trying to get the industry to finally move away and completely deprecate this outdated piece of technology. Do you have a t-shirt that says NTLM should die in a dumpster fire or something? Is that right?
You know, I absolutely should. I mean, honestly, I've been more focused on password security research for the better part of my career. And so that's why I got deep into NTLM, because as one of those protocols, I have an issue with shared secrets and passwords in general, but specifically outdated protocols. And I'm going to clarify, though, my hatred of NTLM version 1 is not Microsoft's fault. Absolutely 100%. It is not Microsoft's fault. It was a product of its time, because back in the day, we had this thing called ITAR, and ITAR restricted strong cryptography. So Microsoft built the best protocol they could with the hand that they were dealt. But this is not 2020. We are not using Windows 2000 and Windows NT 3.5.1 in production anymore. So it's time to move on.
Thank you for that clarification. That was awesome. Oh my gosh. Again, more to unpack. Wendy, where do we go from here?
I would love to start out with what is NTLM version 1? Just for those that maybe are not familiar with it, like myself, and we can go from there.
Okay, so no worries. Let's go back into the days of what LANMAN stands for. So LANMAN was a series of protocols that was used in our specific case for authenticating to devices set back in, say, the Windows NT days, back when we had workgroups pre-domain. There's a whole series of challenge response protocols for authenticating to an SMB share, which is basically a file share in Windows. There's a suite of protocols that systems would use to authenticate to. NTLM version 1 and NTLM version 2, or others known as NetNTLM, were protocols used, you know, that are being deprecated in general. NTLM version 1 is really bad. NTLM version 2 is less bad. And then there's things like Kerberos, which is now the new future, which is one of the great talks we had at Blue Hat about how Microsoft is doing their absolute best to go finally destroy NTLM version 2 and NTLM version 1 in general. But NTLM version 1 specifically relies on DES, or the Data Encryption Standard, another really ancient protocol that was the standard from both the 70s up until the 90s before AES came out. Now, the reason why NTLM version 1 is particularly bad is you basically take a Windows password, standard plain text. It could be up to 128 characters long in the case of a Windows machine account. And this is machine accounts, your trust to Active Directory. Now, you take this 128 character password, you run it through MD4, another old protocol that was ancient but still the cornerstone of most Windows security. Run it through UTF-16 little endian encoding, run it through MD4, and then you convert that into 3 DES keys. And then you do a challenge response, and that's the challenge response based off those DES keys basically is what you use to prove who you are without exchanging your password across the wire. Now, the reason why this is bad is, given the era of really cheap compute, such as with GPUs, you know, I can go summon 80-plus GPUs on IBM Cloud like by snapping my fingers. You can crack those DES keys for about, let's call it $300-$400 in less than a couple of hours, and then derive the NTLM hash from this challenge response. Now, a little feature of Windows, little known feature of Windows is password hashes, such as NTLM specifically, are password equivalent. So I don't need to know the plain text 128 character password. I just need this NTLM hash. And with it, I can create silver tickets. So I can go sign Kerberos tickets on behalf of a domain controller and then execute DC sync, which is directory replication, and suck in all of the password hashes of the entire domain. So we go from having basically regular user access through coerced authentication to domain admin in about 4 hours.
I would like to go backwards in time. Tell us, somewhere in your lifetime, when did you start having that interest in security? Where did you get to the point you are now? Did it start at Tetris, or was this before Tetris? Like, where was Tetris in this timeline, and then what was that timeline?
So my timeline was interesting. When I was going to school, they didn't really even have computer classes in school. Yeah, so I was hacking around back since I was 14, just messing with systems. So let's call this back in the Windows 95 days for ages. But then I just kind of got out of it because I didn't really go to school, couldn't get a job in IT. I packed potato chips for a living until I dislocated my shoulder on an assembly line. And so I wound up going back to school through a government retraining program.
Hang on, how do you dislocate your shoulder on an assembly line packing potato chips? Can I ask that?
Absolutely. So what you do is you pick up bags of chips off the conveyor belt,
yep.
You twist, and you put them in a box. That repetitive motion just caused something to slip.
Oh, wow.
And you know, after I did 3 months of that, I had to go on workers' comp. And I was looking for things to retrain on, and nothing really fit because I didn't really have any schooling. So I managed to pick up a Government of Alberta retraining program where they sent me to SAIT Polytechnic, Calgary-based tech college. And back then we did my MCSA 2003, my CCNA, my Linux Professional Level 1, 2, and 3. And then we bid on a bunch of fake RFPs, et cetera, to basically prepare you for a career in consulting. It was a six-month program. You basically do a year of college in the process. I graduated, and then I wound up somehow in IBM's Global Network Management Center as a network analyst. Did that for a while, and then somehow, magically, I got picked up to go on a contract to Afghanistan hooking up comm towers as a contractor. It was an interesting wild ride. Did a year in Kandahar there and surrounding areas hooking up SATCOM. And then when I got back, I was looking for a pivot into something. And somehow a bank picked me up. It was between me and some guy with his master's in information security. And I got picked, and I asked my boss, hey, why'd you pick me? He was like, we wanted somebody who knew how to deploy technology and wasn't afraid to say, we'll figure this out, as opposed to somebody who had just nothing but book smarts who hadn't had any actual experience in the field. So that Afghanistan experience got me into security. And then from there, we were doing Active Directory password assessments on our environment. And I just somehow became my niche. I got involved in Team Hashcat, started doing password security research. And it was funny because the company at the time had a rule that said any research we do publicly couldn't be under a real name, had to be under a handle. Okay, fine. So I was going under the handle of Mog, and then I met Matthew O'Gorman, who had the same initials, so we deconflicted. I became Evil Mog, he kept the name Mog, and that became my handle that kind of stuck. Sometime in 2015, a graduate student released my name, my cluster size, my company, and my handle in a graduate paper, Usenix 2015. And so I was like, you know what? Cat's out of the bag, steer into the skid. And then my company changed its policy because of it. And now that's how Evil Mog and Dustin Haywood started becoming famous, doing things like DerbyCon for a conference for ages since it hit. And then X-Force stole me from the bank that I was at. And now here we are.
Oh my gosh, I have so many questions.
I hear DerbyCon's awesome. I think it's gone now, but I always wanted to go.
Okay, first question. These potato chips that you were packing into boxes, were these the famous and difficult to acquire in the US of A tomato ketchup chips?
No, the plant I was working at was mostly corn-based stuff. So I was working for Old Dutch at the time, or one of their contractors. So it was like, picture like your Doritos, your corn tortilla chips, your extruder-based kind of puffed corn style things, those styles of chips.
So follow-up question, as a chip expert, or at least a brief chip expert from a professional sense, why can't we buy those ketchup chips here in the US? Do you have any insight into this? Because they are absolutely delicious and you can't find them anywhere.
They are absolutely addictive, and I think we should be exporting them. I think it's honestly due to some weird trade agreement that says we can't export them to your lovely country.
Oh, wow. So there actually might be like an economic policy reason.
Pretty much. That's my guess anyways. I mean, the US FDA likes to, you know, support American industry a lot, so they kind of restrict all the cool things. It's like we can't export Kinder Eggs to the US unless we modify them, because they're apparently deemed a hazard in the US.
Yes, that's because we would inadvertently eat them, you know, the toys as well, and then choke and die, because that's just how it works over here.
We can't be trusted. We cannot.
I was hoping for a silly answer. You gave me a very real answer. Thank you for that. Team Hashcat, I sort of generally know about Team Hashcat, but I don't know like the history. Can you give folks just a sort of a quick little primer? What is Team Hashcat and what does it mean to be a part of Team Hashcat?
Okay, so there's a contest every year at DEF CON called Crack Me If You Can. And there's a number of other password cracking contests where there's really two divisions inside these contests. There's the amateurs, you know, single person, couple of GPUs, and then there's what we call the pro divisions. Now, the pro division is the people who develop password cracking software, methodologies, and have access to entire data centers of gear on command. So being a part of Team Hashcat, I'm on the pro division, and we compete in password cracking competitions. We've come in first or second every year at Crack Me If You Can in the pro division, just ever since it started the last 10 years. I got involved because I had one of the largest crypto clusters before cryptocurrencies in Western Canada, in fact, North America. We had 64-plus GPUs, and I was at the bank back before Bitcoin mining became a thing. So that was how I'd come up. Is I'd bring an entire data center with the gear and just slap it down. Here we are. And I was also one of their primary pattern analysts. So I developed a couple of rules inside Hashcat, like generated 2-dot rule, a couple of methodologies like raking, for example, where you randomly generate rules, use the same word list and just loop over them, collecting all the ones that would actually work. So early AI, before AI became a thing, stuff like that.
And why did you have such a huge cluster at the bank? What were you using it for? Were you using it for like password authentication security?
Password auditing, yeah. Entirely password security research. Because with that world, we were involved in payment research. We're a crown corporation, so we had a bit more latitude in terms of what we'd spend our money on. And I just had a really cool boss who's like, look, you know, this research you're doing here is keeping us safe. So what do you need? So I had a mild budget to keep upgrading my GPUs every couple of years and building together, you know, hacked together Haji, hacked together systems of hodgepodge together milk crate systems, etc. So open air, no chassis, 4 GPUs slammed in there, stuck in a wiring closet with adequate cooling. I did a talk on how not to set your GPUs on fire back in the day called Confessions of a Crypto Cluster Operator.
Oh, that sounds like the good old days. And now, if you could tell us a little bit, what is X-Force? You are the chief architect of X-Force. That just that title sounds amazing. I'd take it, having no idea what I'm supposed to be doing. I just want that title. What do you do and what is X-Force?
Okay, so X-Force is IBM's team of incident responders, penetration testers, adversarial simulation, reverse engineers, threat intelligence experts. Basically, we get involved in almost everything. So you get hacked, you bring your incident responders in, we deal with it. We have our active threat assessment teams. You want us to penetrate things? We have everything from nation state emulation all the way down to general penetration testing, and it's global. So my role is I'm basically the chief goat herder. I handle all the technology stacks globally, whether it's our incident responders, whether it's our pen testers, whether it's our command and control networks, our data honeypots all across the world. Ultimately, it rolls up through me and my various teams.
So is X-Force separate from another cybersecurity division?
Yeah, we're part of cybersecurity services inside IBM. We're basically an amalgamation of all the various groups that got put together because, you know, say, for example, you're doing a pen test, you want to find out, you know, how these people detect things, or detection gets involved with our various purple team exercises. We're just always better together. So we also send details out to X-Force Exchange and other IBM product units based off our research.
X-Force Exchange, is that external? Like, it's like a...
Yeah, it's basically sticks and taxi data that we do. So say you have IBM Q Radar and you want to pull in threat intelligence data, we can push things right down to a SIM and then you're getting X-Force data delivered right down with your incidents. It's actually pretty cool.
That sounds cool.
If I may, I'd like to bring us to your Blue Hat presentation from this year. The video is up on YouTube. We'll make sure there's a link in the show notes. It was a very brief session. It was a 15-minute lightning talk, which happens at lunch. We intentionally put you directly before the follow-up session on the actual Microsoft's actual plan for deprecating NTLM. And so that was sort of an interesting sort of back and forth that was able to happen there. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what it is that you presented in your lightning talk? And I think the other question that I sort of wanted to ask was, do you have any data? Like, you know, one of the things that you say in this talk is that NTLM is really old, especially V1. And it was, you know, broken a long, long time ago, but it's still prevalent. Do you have any sort of data or even just sort of estimates of how prevalent it is and how much it is still being used?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my talk, first of all, was I gave a 100% live demo with all my slides delivered in the terminal of how to crack NTLM version 1, because I believe in living dangerously. I mean, everyone does their slides. I like to be, you know, edgy because it's fun. We started off with firing up Responder. Responder is a tool to perform, basically it responds to NTLM challenges and elicits them. In this case, we just had it in respond-only mode. Then what we did was we used a tool called Coercer. Now, Coercer is a tool that's basically used for auth coercion. There's various methods to elicit coercion from, say, a domain controller. In this case, we used a Server 2019 domain controller, fully patched, with one particular setting set on it called the LANMAN compatibility level. If that setting and group policy on the domain controller is set to 2 or lower, you're basically vulnerable and allows the NTLM version 1. So what we did is we enabled auth coercion. So you can use print spooler, EFS services. There is a number of other methods to force a domain controller to authenticate to you. So what we did is we used regular user, forced the domain controller to send back an authentication challenge to us. In this case, I believe we're using EFS. In that authentication challenge, it had an NTLM version 1 packet, or challenge response. From there, we took the tool, and when I say we, I mean I, took the challenge response, and ran it through a tool that I wrote called the NTLM version 1 multi-tool that's up on GitHub. Now, what the NTLM version 1 multi-tool does is it reformats your challenge into a method that is crackable by Hashcat. So it outputs the hash file for you and tells you the command to run. Now, normally with a single GPU, you're looking at 6-7 days. With a cluster, you're looking at a couple of hours. In this case, I had it pre-cracked on my laptop, so I could demo it using hey, here it is already cracked. That way, it could keep within the 10-minute timeline. So we then reversed the NTLM version 1 challenge into an NTLM hash, then used it to proceed to synchronize against the domain controller, extracting all the hashes out. I also displayed a block diagram on the presentation there about how the NTLM version 1 challenge response is calculated, which explained why this actually works. NTLM version 2 doesn't have this issue because they switched to MD5 HMAC, and there's no known attack against MD5 HMAC that would enable this to work. However, there are other techniques that would enable NTLM version 2 to be abused, things like dropping the message integrity codes, which is why Microsoft's looking to get rid of that in particular. But NTLM version 1, if it's enabled, you can basically assume it's been compromised, versus version 2 requires a little bit more gymnastics on behalf of a tester. So as for data, I see NTLM version 1 enabled in about 3 out of every 10 pen tests. So let's call it 30% of clients still have it enabled because they have some legacy system, such as an old CNC machine, an old hospital x-ray machine. We see it so often that I'm literally doing an NTLM crack run weekly, and it's the first thing we put on our list, fix the LANMAN compatibility level. And if it's not at the domain controller, it's on at least one server somewhere, so it gets a foothold.
You literally answered my question I was going to ask you. Why are people still using this?
So 30% of the pen tests that you and your team run, you're going to find NTLM V1 because there is some piece of technology, some piece of equipment that is from the 80s or the 90s and requires Landman compatibility. Is it as simple as that?
Or some kind of software that requires it, or say a piece of hardware such as a printer, or someone set this domain up and they've been doing, say, upgrades. Like, to say they upgrade the server functionality level, but they don't change the GPOs. Default new installations these days mandate 2 or higher. It might even be 3 or higher at this point. In fact, I've seen some as high as 5. But if you intentionally have to go turn this on new domains, but old legacy domains have been around forever, migrated, changed, moved, merged. There's always at least one domain somewhere in an enterprise with this turned on.
I just want to stick with this scenario just for one more time. So you're a domain administrator, you're IT in an organization, at a company, and you're doing some sort of upgrade or you're applying some sort of security best policy, best practice. You're going to that level 2 or 3 or higher. And then someone says, like, my CNC machine doesn't work, or that, you know, large format printer in the basement that we use once every 3 weeks has stopped working. And they go, oh, all right, well, I guess we'll have to turn back on Landman compatibility so that thing will work. And then they do that and the thing works and everyone's happy. And they don't realize what they've actually done is they've opened themselves up to a plethora, a world of vulnerabilities, because they're just trying to make some division or some individual, some team happy because they have a piece of legacy hardware or software that needs NTLM V1. Is it as simple as that? That's the scenario?
It's as simple as that, right? It's just like print spooler. We all had print spooler enabled on domain controllers for ages. In some companies, the only print server was the domain controllers that enabled. Here's the thing. Businesses aren't in the business of keeping an environment secure. They're in the business of making money. And the second something interrupts the flow of money, none of this other stuff may as well exist. And it's the unfortunate fact of life. That's just I was an IT guy. I understand where the bodies are buried because I put some of them there.
Sorry, well, I shouldn't laugh. Wendy, go.
Oh, I was going to say, for those that are listening that do know they still have this enabled somewhere in their systems, can you share any real-world examples of folks that have used this and it led to something really unfortunate?
Just don't name names.
Yeah, so I was doing, I was doing an industrial control environment. And they were like, oh yeah, we're totally secure, not a problem. So they plopped me down in the corporate world. Okay, fine, no worries. I'm scanning around. They must have had a couple thousand systems. I found 3 systems, and they were all in this security zone running the building access control system that all had NTLM version 1 enabled. I went, did my little crack, came back the next day with the results. From there, they had somebody's session running. We managed to go extract the DP API keys out, decrypt everything that was stored in their browser session history, and lo and behold, there's the links to the company password manager. Only it's like some open source solution that happens to be stored on a file share. Download the database, grab the password out, and there's all the domain admin passwords for the domain. We then escalate up. We pop into the next tier, which was their industrial control systems network. We then find some vendor's remote access solution, crawl in through there, get right into the plant level where we could see, like, here's actual control of the environment. We took a screenshot, closed down all the windows, wrote the report, because I'm not touching anything once you're inside the real world.
Wow. So what would be the guidance to people listening to this podcast who want to essentially audit their system and make sure that they don't have, for all this legacy equipment that they may have, legacy software that they may have, that they're not inadvertently making themselves vulnerable because they've got some Landman or NTLM V1 compatibility setting turned on somewhere? Like, how do you go find that?
Honestly, go into your group policies. That's the first thing. Because right now there's a registry key setting you can set. But the biggest thing is go into your group policy objects and just audit every single one, why they're applied. Make sure the systems are still there. IT asset management, oddly enough, is the single hardest problem in information security. Everything else is kind of secondary. Knowing where your assets are, what requires them, and if you put an exception in, review that risk at least annually. If you do absolutely need to use it for this one particular service, make sure that group policy objects only apply to that system and make sure nothing even remotely privileged touches it. Like Microsoft has their tier 0, tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, you know, layered access models, etc., with Red Forest and all the magic, or whatever they call it now these days. Make sure that none of your privileged users go anywhere near something with LANMAN version 1 or NTLM version 1 turned on. That's the biggest thing. If you keep the privileges out of that memory and use like local authentication only or your local admin password for maintaining it, you know, regular user creds with nothing sensitive, okay, you can probably quarantine off. Like, here's your CNC operator, dedicated AD user for logging onto the system. That's one thing. You know, risks happen. We need to deal with them. But treat it like, put it off in the corner, put a giant wall around it, make sure nothing can touch it, and then audit your group policy objects. There's more stuff in there that you should probably go through. You know, say you've set password requirements to be 14 characters long and change every 90 days. But, you know, there's this one legacy system that's, oh, yeah, we're going to turn on reversible password encryption, and we're going to set the password to 8 characters for this one particular weird use case because it's a kiosk somewhere. Just know your settings and make sure it gets checked and signed off by more than one person.
Wow. Okay, so that's incredible advice for, you know, how to go and find this stuff and then, you know, obviously keep an eye on it. What about the scenario where, again, someone listening to this podcast that is that network administrator that is in IT and they've been told by someone in their leadership, someone senior to them, I don't care, we need that CNC machine connected and working because that's how our business runs or whatever, whatever. How does one, obviously you could bring in IBM X-Force and they could run a penetration test. And as you say, they would get this report and the report would sort of detail everything. But how does the individual in an IT team or in a security team, how do they sort of build a case or make an argument that says, hey, we actually need to make some changes, which may even result in let's get rid of this CNC machine from 1987 or let's upgrade this CNC machine from 1987 because the risk of this being abused, this vulnerability being abused, is going to far outweigh what it would cost to sort of make this upgrade or whatever. How do you make that case? I know that's something that your team does.
Oh, that's actually a very good question though, right? I mean, that's what I like seeing about the industry as a whole. But back in the 90s and 2000s, we always just focused on technical risk rather than business risk. I mean, we weren't required to be business people. Nowadays, we have the rise of the BISO, the Business Information Security Officer. We have the rise of people needing to be more business focused. Because like I said, no company cares about the technology stack. They care about making money. So it comes down to what is the cost of an outage, the cost of this machine being down, versus the cost of a data breach. I mean, X-Force puts out a report every year called the cost of a data breach report. You know, you look into the cost of bringing in incident responders on your worst day, the cost of reputational loss when, you know, you find out you've been in the news. You've got the cost of cleanup and remediation. Like, all these costs add up. You put a dollar towards those costs, then you say, here's the cost of the breach, add them all up, versus the cost of upgrading the CNC machine, and your business case becomes rather apparent rather quick. But the important part is now we can't rely just purely on technical skills. We need to have business skills in our industry, and that's something people should be focusing on. Business skills, presentation skills, you know, so we can more clearly articulate these risks and bring it to a business level context.
I have like 20 follow-up questions. So again, like, you know what, I think we could talk about this for the next hour. So I'll just try and sort of wrap it up with one final question is, are there good resources out there? Are there good tools out there? Are there good trainings out there that you're aware of? And it's okay if you're not, we can follow up on another episode. But how does one develop those skills, or how does one take advantage of sort of the templates or the tools that are already out there? Again, I'm an individual. I'm working at my company. I've been told by my leadership that I have to go do this thing that I know is risky, but I need to pull together some sort of argument or document or piece of data that's going to change their mind. I love the idea if we need to skill people up so that they have presentation skills and they can, you know, convince their leadership to make changes. Are you familiar with tools or programs or
things?
There's
no real training or tools like that. I mean, realistically, say you want to talk to a finance person. You say, hey, look, you know, let's go talk the same language. How do you need to have this risk articulated if you're going to make a decision? It really starts with the conversation. And if they happen to have tools in, say, the finance world, say in banking, we add banking risk, you know, templates. In insurance, they have insurance risk. If it's, you know, some sawmill somewhere, you go talk to your accounting guy and say, hey, look, the cost of an outage is this. Here's the cost of this upgrade here. Oddly enough, you'll find the finance people, the easiest people to get on board with articulating risk, because they already have existing tools to help calculate them. I mean, none of our IT tools are built towards articulating financial risk. But when you tie business into finance risk...
I love it. So go find an ally in finance and maybe have coffee with them or lunch or something like that. So go form an allyship with finance.
That's the best idea. Yeah, or someone in the business, right? I mean, that's the biggest thing. Understanding your business is the most important thing you can do as a security person. Because, you know, I can make the most secure computer in the world by dumping it in the Mariana Trench, surrounding it with submarines and filling it with concrete. It ain't going to be useful. So, you know, IT security should not be a cost center, period. We should be a business enabler. The brakes in a race car make it go faster, not slower. And so adding that business risk context to things and knowing your business, talking to your business leaders, how can you help? Building that rapport is really the biggest thing you can do.
Yeah, because I can see just talking to fellow cybersecurity professionals, I mean, that's a feedback loop at that point. Like, you know what the risk is. It's getting those in the business side to understand, like, maybe we should take a look at this a little closer. That's great advice. I agree. Yeah.
Like, what if, you know, all of a sudden your entire business was shut down because you lost the production line because someone hacked the CNC machine? What kind of outage would that cause? Just asking simple questions like that. And that goes into a simple spreadsheet of cost of an outage, cost of this, cost of that, versus the cost of remediation. Excel, oddly enough, can become your greatest tool in this.
Who knew?
Which, oddly enough, is a Microsoft product. Go figure. I use spreadsheets and CSV more than I use IT security tools these days.
Yeah. I think showing the cost, I think that's the real... The conversation started there. Having to let all your customers know the whole thing. That's a big undertaking. Aside from the topic at Blue Hat, what else are you passionate about? Is there anything else? I mean, and this does not have to be within the security realm. It could be anything. And I have a couple of topics that I want to ask you about, but I want to see what you are passionate about.
You know, my biggest thing, honestly, is finding something outside of IT and outside of work to keep yourself sane. Everybody in this industry is subject to burnout. It's just because of the nature of what we do. Pen testing in particular, you're going to spend thousands of hours beating your head against the wall because nothing's working. Then all of a sudden, something magically works. You get that dopamine rush. All of a sudden, you're happy. This is the best thing in the world. And then all of a sudden, you drop back down again to, oh my God, this sucks. I'm the worst hacker in the world because nothing's working because the company's doing their job. I do everything. I do a lot of high adrenaline sports. I used to scuba dive. I fly gliders. I ride motorcycles. I go out for hikes. I hang out with cats. I get involved in pyrotechnics, oddly enough. That was the one that kind of comes up a fair bit. I'm a licensed special effects pyrotechnician, so that's a good outlet. Realistically, anything that gets me involved in doing something not work.
I like the dangerous sports and dangerous things you include, hanging out with cats.
Oh, dude, yeah. Absolutely. You go volunteer at a pet shelter, and you're going to get claws all through your arms up and down. That's probably the most dangerous things ever.
Big cats or like domesticated cats? House cats and plural.
Oh yeah, I occasionally been known to show up to the odd pet shelter and, you know, spend the day feeding kitties and, you know, cuddling them and entertaining them when I can't find anything else to do. I joke that I'm never having kids, so when I die, donate all my money to a pet shelter somewhere and call her a day.
Do you have your own pet cats?
Oh yeah, I got two of them, Super and Ubsy.
Are they shelter rescue cats or are they?
Oh, absolutely. So funny story, I used to collect Toyota Supras. I had two 93.5 Mark IV twin turbos I bought for myself after I got out of Afghanistan because you can import the ones from Japan. I sold them to put a down payment on my house. And then, you know, I'm allergic to cats. My wife wanted cats, so we compromised and got a cat. I got catnapped from breakfast one day, dragged down to the shelter, and there's this cute little deli tortoise shell that kind of just rolled over, put her paws out, and was like, "Daddy." I'm like, okay, that's the one. But it was just a number to me, right? I didn't look at her name. I go back the next day to pick her up. Wouldn't you know it, the cat's name is Supra. So the joke is I traded my twin turbo cars for a twin turbo cat, and I didn't even have to name her, and she's such a daddy's kitty.
Now, you're allergic to cats?
Yeah. I take Reactin daily.
You take what, sorry?
Reactin, allergy meds daily.
Oh my gosh, because without that, you wouldn't be able to live with a cat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just one of those things. I love the little things, but, you know,
Your body does not.
My body does not.
Have you ever combined your love of cats and pyrotechnics? Stay with me. And designed a pyrotechnic show or a pyrotechnic...
Oddly enough, yes.
Oh.
So, I'm sure you're familiar with an event called Burning Man down in the States.
I've heard of it.
Okay, yeah, giant party in the desert. Well, there's a regional one here called Freezer Burn. Alberta's regional Burning Man event.
Because you're in Calgary.
Exactly. I thought it was hilarious. So it's up by Pinoca. And one year, the year of the pandemic, when the event wasn't running, there was an unofficial one. And someone built a giant cat out of pallets.
Okay.
Let's call it about 30 feet tall. And my job is the ignition assurance coordinator.
Assurance coordinator. So your job is to ensure that it ignites, that it burns.
Yes, 100%.
Okay.
And how that started was somebody burnt their eyebrows off by pouring gas in an already burning fire one year. I said, look, I'm actually certified in a couple of things. I'm trained by ERD. Let me take over. And so I did. So we used road flares, electronic matches, gas or diesel technically, and a little bit of gasoline, fuel sprayers. And we set them all off remotely so that the structure burns with everyone far away. And I have an SLA. The structure's down in 20 minutes or less. And
or
that's
your
it.
Money back. Oh.
Exactly. I mean, I'm free, so, you know.
I love the SLA.
Wow. I honestly thought I was going to stump you with combining cats and pyrotechnics. But no, that's awesome. We're coming up on time, Dustin, but you know, what other projects are you working on? Where are you presenting next? What's something you would like to plug to the Blue Hat podcast audience or any other sort of stories you'd like to share from Blue Hat? Was this your first Blue Hat? No, you've been before, right?
This is my first Blue Hat.
It's your first Blue Hat. Wow. Okay. Will you be back? Maybe that's my first
Absolutely.
Question.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll definitely be down. That was one of the best events ever, getting backend access to discuss issues that you normally wouldn't be able to discuss with Microsoft folks, and having like genuine engaged vendor feedback was one of the coolest things ever. So yeah, I'll help you back as long as you guys keep inviting me.
Wonderful. What would you want to present on next time? Or is that?
I have no idea yet. I'm kind of figuring things out. I mean, the next thing I'm working on these days is SSH certificates and trying to get rid of static SSH keys across the world. I got this hatred of static credentials. Do they lead to compromise? I'm not sure if it's going to lead to a product or research or what have you. So that's what I'm currently looking into now. I'm sure I'll find something that scratches my niche. There's the new stuff that Steve's working on with the new funky Kerberos things to get rid of NTLM version 2. So I'll be probably researching that over the next 6 months and finding out anything entertaining and probably presenting my findings, or at least, you know, chatting with Steve about it at Blue Hat, guaranteed.
And that was Steve Cyphus.
Cyphus.
Cyphus. Gosh, Steve, I'm sorry. I pronounced his name wrong every time.
I can never pronounce his name either. So
I'm sure you pronounce it. Steve, I'm just apologies again, man. I always get your name wrong. So sorry. and his session was immediately following you. I talked about that earlier, called Deprecating NTLM is Easy and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves, which is just a beautiful title. I love the sort of tongue-in-cheek approach there. Would you recommend watching your lightning talk first and then Steve's second? I personally would.
Yes, just, absolutely. And I loved Steve's talk, by the way. I was like on the edge of my seat listening to the entire thing. Such an interesting story about printers were the one thing that wound up being one of the biggest culprits. But I think his roadmap is absolutely achievable. And I think people should watch it and get learning the newest way of doing things at Microsoft. And please, for the love of God, turn off NTLM version 1. But, you know, go to Kerberos only. I love Kerberos. The new techniques are great. I think Steve's got a great roadmap. And I'm looking forward to him making my job far more difficult. He's going to ruin 10 years of training and tooling with that once he gets this going, and I'm here all for it.
And it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a presence on social media? Is there anywhere that folks can find you?
So I like to post dad jokes on Twitter a lot. I myself am not a parent, so that makes me a bit of a faux pas, but I'm evil_mog on Twitter. Feel free to browse that for cat jokes and the occasional talk about password security, but really a lot of dad jokes.
And how many of them are you actually creating? Because, I mean, I follow you on Twitter. Oh, you're just reposting.
I'm a filter. So what I do is I'm on Meta and a number of various side meme groups, and I basically cherry pick the best ones, filter them out. You know, like that episode off South Park where Stan has to filter Cartman's social media? That's basically what I do for the rest of you, only for dad jokes.
So thank you for taking that on. The reason I ask is that I don't often see, attribution. And so I don't necessarily mean to be critical here, but I just, you know, wondered, you know, do you create some of these or and no attribution or, I mean, it's because it's impossible, right? This is meme.
It's impossible. Like, I'm trying to figure out who actually, I initially find out who created the initial meme. And if I can, I'll put an attribution to it. But the problem is these memes have been recycled so many times over the years and mildly modified that it's next to impossible. If there is attribution built into the meme, I do not filter out attribution. Like, you'll see some Riker's beard from the Star Trek crap posting ones I do. You'll see a number of comics. I make sure all original markings are attached so you can at least find who created them. But some of these, there's just no attribution in meme land, so they just get spread.
There's no way to find the so many of these memes that you find. They're just amazing, but who knows who created it? Whoever did originally, we appreciate it.
I filter about 90% of the memes I post because some of them really should never see the light of day, at least in polite society. And so those wind up going into like a dev null bit bucket, and you only get like the cream of the crop that's, you know, at least publicly shareable.
Vetted. Appreciated. Thank you.
Hey, who knows? You can gain 20,000 followers just from posting memes.
It's true. I'm a fan. Well, thank you for being here. It was really neat to learn about pyrotechnics and Hashcat and X-Force. I didn't know about this, so this was great, and I'm sure the listeners were loving it. So thank you, and we'd love to have you back again. But there are so many more things we need to talk to you about. I know Nick probably has a list of like 42 questions that he still needs to ask you.
I'm down for being on your podcast anytime. You folks have been fantastic. Any topic's good for me, so let me know.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for joining the Blue Hat Podcast. We'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us for the Blue Hat Podcast.
If you have feedback, topic requests, or questions about this episode,
please email us at bluehat@microsoft.com or message us on Twitter at @MSFTBlueHat.
Be sure to subscribe for more conversations and insights from security researchers and responders across the industry
by visiting bluehatpodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.